With the holiday shopping season upon us, how about a good book or two for the readers on your Christmas list? I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 books as Kansas Notable Books. In the second of a two-part series, we'll hear from the authors of many of those books, including fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult literature, and more. If you missed last week's KPR Presents, part one of my 2015 Kansas Notable Books program, you can listen to it anytime on our website, kpr.ku.edu. While you're there, you can enter a chance to win a Kansas Notable Book. Go to kpr.ku.edu, click on Extras, and then Available Giveaways. Our first Kansas Notable Book of 2015 is Waiting on the Sky. It's a collection of essays by Emporia writer Cheryl Unruh. Her column, Flyover People, appears in the Emporia Gazette. These two essays were previously published in the Gazette and were heard on KPR's Morning Edition.
A small town is pieced together with alleys. As a teenager, I ran through shadow-filled alleys after dark, playing hide-and-seek with classmates. I hung on in the back seat as a friend fishtailed her Suburban through snowy alleyways at night. And sometimes I rode my bike down the alleys, its tires slowed by the thick sand. Recently, while looking at photographs of my hometown, Pawnee Rock, I paused when I saw a picture of our family alley. It wasn't actually our alley, it was in the block to the south of us, but I think our family used it more than anyone else. It was one of the pathways my mom, dad, brother, and I took to get downtown, to where my mom worked at the post office and the dress shop, to my dad's woodworking shop, to the grocery store. When I was young, skipping alongside mom or dad, I might have chased a butterfly or stopped at a patch of clover to look for four leaves. The paths of our childhood may be where our poems begin. We can all think of various pathways in our lives. Maybe we recall our walking route to grade school or to English 101. Perhaps you're thinking of the worn line in the grass between the parking lot and your office. Along these trails, these sidewalks, these alleyways, we've carried our thoughts, our sorrows, our joys. My favorite thing about this particular alley was that it was adjacent to what I call the forest. In Kansas, if you hold your arms straight out, spin in a circle, and hit two or more trees with your hands, that's a forest. I think this lot was originally a tree nursery before I was born. But in my time, it was a fairly dense, tree-filled place with shaggy underbrush and even a caved-in cellar. One had to climb over a lazy fence to get in, but the forest was a good hideout for a kid, especially one who watched Daniel Boone and liked to pretend that she was an Indian. The other day when I came across a photograph of that alley, I thought about how there is more meaning to this alley than is visible in a picture. In that photo, there are things that only I can see. I recall the day I turned 8. I galloped down that alley to get the mail and felt like the luckiest kid on the planet. My mom had just told me that I had a new cousin, Doug, and that he had been born on my birthday. I remembered one day walking home from the Pawnee Rock dress shop, where I'd purchased, for $1, a pair of tiny folding scissors in a red vinyl pouch to give to my mom for Mother's Day. I thought about how excited she would be to have this tiny pair of scissors. Occasionally, Mom put 61 cents into my palm and sent me on a mission. At Karis's grocery store, I'd walk through the screen door and across the wooden floor to order a pound of hamburger. At the meat counter, Mr. Karis scooped ground beef into a paper tray, weighed it, wrapped it, and wrote 59 cents on the butcher paper. In the front of the store, Mrs. Karis collected my coins, and I'd walk home with the main ingredient for supper. That alley took me to the post office thousands of times to collect mail from box number 7. When I got letters from my Arkansas grandma or from a pen pal, I'd open the envelopes right there and read the letters while walking home. We've each left our footsteps and our thoughts on various pathways in our lives. And we can go back any time to retrieve those memories. They're still there, right where we left them.
That's Cheryl Unruh reading her essay, The Alley. It's part of her collection, Waiting on the Sky, More Flyover People Essays, the first of today's Kansas Notable Books of 2015. As is this essay, originally published in the Emporia Gazette, Tumbling Tumbleweeds.
Just as many of us like to roam across Kansas, Russian thistles, too, are full of wanderlust. I don't think about tumbleweeds often, but I was reminded of them on a trip to Dodge City with my friend Tracy Simmons. Russian thistles thrive in the western half of the state. They grow like weeds there. Apparently, it takes a lot of space and fresh air to raise these things. I miss tumbleweeds, I told Tracy when we first encountered them near Cullison in Pratt County. She said, when tumbleweeds blow across the fields, they look like animals moving. I imagine that tumbleweeds often bounce for miles, crossing property and jurisdiction lines. Maybe we could tag some of these tumblers and see just how far they do venture from their source. But the lives of tumbleweeds can get cut short. With no road crossing skills, they may wind up under the brutal tires of a Kenworth or get caught in the undercarriage of a Camry and scrape the highway for the next 13 miles. Many tumbleweeds are snagged by barbed wire fences, where they remain imprisoned until they dissolve into the dust from which they came. Gypsy-like by nature, it's not surprising that these thistles came all the way from Russia. Michael John Haddock, author of Wildflowers and Grasses of Kansas, describes them as such. Russian thistle is a prolific seed producer. The stems break at ground level and roll in the wind, causing the seeds to fall. Thus, the common name tumbleweed. The seeds require only limited moisture to germinate. Haddock wrote that the thistle was thought to have arrived in the Great Plains in the mid-1870s with flaxseed imported from Russia. Well, tumbleweeds are ours now. On the way to Dodge City, Tracy and I drove through strong crosswinds. Wind speed is relative, though. It may not have been overly windy according to Western Kansas standards. Dodge City enjoys an average annual wind speed of 14 miles per hour and is high on the list of windiest cities in the contiguous United States. Having grown up with the wind and the tumbleweeds in Barton County, I may miss the companionship of these rolling weeds, but I sure don't miss the nagging wind. That day, the wind blasted us from the south, steady at 30 miles an hour and gusting even stronger. Wind breaks came in the way of semi-trucks traveling in the opposite direction. When an eastbound truck passed us, it blocked the south wind momentarily, pulling the car dangerously toward the center line. But the suction was brief. When the truck passed, the wind returned, pushing the car toward the ditch. It was a two hands on the steering wheel kind of day. We are warned in the case of flash flooding that 2 feet of water can float a vehicle, but we are never told about dramatic wind currents, which can also float your car across the highway. Wind is an invisible element, and it's something of a daily hymn in the western half of Kansas. You cannot see the wind, but neither can you miss its presence. It can slam car doors shut or push an old barn to the ground, and it's the worst hairstylist ever. But wind has a purpose. The tumbleweed would be nothing without the wind beneath its wings.
Again, that's Cheryl Unruh reading from Waiting on the Sky, More Flyover People Essays. It's the first of today's Kansas Notable Books of 2015, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. Joe Schrag of Wakarusa is the author of our second Kansas Notable Book. It's The Kansas Relays, Track and Field Tradition in the Heartland. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
Let's start back at the beginning. How did the Kansas Relays get its start?
They started because of a man named John Outland, who in the 1890s was an All-American football player for KU for 2 years. Then he went to the University of Pennsylvania, where he was also an All-American. While he was there, the Penn Relays, which had just gotten started in the 1890s, caught his attention. Outland came back to Kansas in 1900, settled in Topeka for a year or two, coached football at Washburn, and did his medical practice until he moved to Kansas City in 1900. And it was then that he was on the athletic board for KU, along with Fog Allen and other notables. And he said, what KU needs is a track meet to attract people to the campus, like the Penn Relays. Unfortunately, there were no facilities available for that. So the facilities became available in 1921. In 1920, Fog Allen was a football coach, oddly enough, for 1 year. And they had a thrilling come-from-behind tie with overpowering Nebraska at 20-20. And the student body was so excited about that that they pledged lots of dollars for a new stadium. And the students helped pitch in to demolish the old stadium. And they built a new stadium that was open for football in 1920. First victory was over K-State. And then by 1923, Outland and Allen and a fellow named Schlademan, who had been a KU coach for about 4 years and was building up the KU program, were given the go-ahead to start the relays. And so they did that, and first year, despite a lot of rain, it still worked, and they decided to keep it going.
One of the things I really enjoyed reading about that first relays was the effort not just to get athletes to come, but to get students to attend it.
It was the case where they felt like it would be disrespectful for students not to come. So they actually extended the Easter vacation so it would not start until the end of Friday. And that way students would not have had time to go home and hopefully would stay for the relays. And even the University Daily Kansan made a rather scolding column. We've got to come here and show support for these relays. Otherwise, if we didn't, it would be like inviting people to your home and not being there to greet them. And so that was one of the ways they tried to get people involved.
The Kansas Relays has always been rich in traditions. Tell me about some of the early Kansas Relays traditions.
It was more of a spectacle in the early years. It was a week-long spectacle. And Fog Allen was quite a promoter. And he felt that it was not enough just to put on the relays. They had to be promoted. And so some of the early things that they did, they had a rodeo, a rodeo on Friday night after the high school meet. And they had a buffalo, which they allowed to graze on the field, and then they butchered him for the coaches and officials' meal the next day. They had the students guess the weight of the buffalo, and the ones that guessed it most correctly got 4 free tickets to the relays the next day. Second place got free tickets, and third place also a few, but that was a way to get the students involved. Other promotions were amazing. They had actually had a golf driving tournament for both professionals and amateurs, and they had nearly 30 entries. And what they did in the morning, they would tee off from the middle of the football field and drive shots to the Campanile Hill, where they had a kind of a grill where they were scored according to that. And then in the afternoon, they took the top five and they repeated the process. So from the 50-yard line of the football field to Campanile Hill. That was, of course, before the days of the scoreboard and other things. That was one of the things they did. They also took a barnstorming flight to rural Kansas cities. Story has it, and Art Dozell, who is a famous runner here, tells about this. He wrote a master's thesis on the first 50 years of KU track, which goes clear back to the 1860s and 70s. But he tells about that week and about how that airplane hit a tree and got damaged a little bit, and they had to take it into, I believe it was Abilene, for repairs. But they wore white coats and had KU relays on the back and were ambassadors for the relays at an early year.
There was also a Kansas Relays Queen.
There was a queen, and there was a parade downtown. There were all sorts of promotional things going on.
I'm going to pick your brain a little bit about some of the various Kansas Relays throughout the year. people who run in the Kansas Relays to this day, people compete in the Glenn Cunningham Mile.
Yes.
Tell me about him.
Glenn Cunningham competed in 1930s. He ran, I believe, he ran at the relays, I think, 16 years. I may be wrong about that. He always had good competition from other competitors as well. But the marvelous thing about Glenn Cunningham is that he overcame so much adversity. He was burned badly in his youth because he and his brother, who was killed in the incident, would go early to light the fire in the schoolhouse that they went to. And he was so badly burned, his legs were so badly burned, that he was told he would never walk again. And through sheer force of will and a mother that inspired him and worked with him and challenged him, he pulled himself up along the fence one day and kind of crawled along the fence, drug himself along, and gradually began to run to try to improve his legs, and became a world record holder and an Olympian.
That's an incredible story.
It really is.
Let me go back a couple more years to 1927 and what was called one of the most ambitious Kansas Relays promotions.
Okay, in 1927, the Tarahumara Indians came to the relays. And the way that all came about is that Mexico had just undergone a revolution, and they wanted to find places to promote national pride. And one of the ways to do that was athletically. And so they staged a long run in Texas. Texas Relays got a hold of that, and they ran an 80-mile run to Austin from wherever they started. I'm not sure. But Fog Allen, ever the promoter, said, this is something we can do. And so he got with the Mexican government, and they sent some Tarahumara Indians. These are from the Copper Canyon, remote Mexico. They didn't speak the language or anything like that, but and they were afraid to run. According to Fog Allen, who was sometimes prone to hyperbole, said that one came only because he was threatened by the chief that if he didn't come, he would be killed. That story could not be verified, but that's some of the mythology that's arisen around this. But three of them came, three men and two women. The men were to run from Kansas City to Memorial Stadium and finish up on the track. The women, there were only two of them, sisters, were to run from Topeka, 30 miles. Well, they did that in order to give the men competition. Two Haskell runners also ran. The foremost runner, he ran it in under 7 hours. And the second runner was a Haskell runner who had never run more than 20 miles in his life. His name was Purcell. And the third runner was a fellow named Thomas, who, when he entered the stadium, the 2-mile relay was just finishing up. A Haskell runner had the baton in his left hand and was running in the stadium. The Tarahumara runner, they ran with these long sticks that were about almost a yard long. I don't know why they did that, but they did that. And so one of the great pictures in the book is a picture of Philip Osif, the Haskell runner, very good national class runner, and the Tarahumara runner running side by side with, he had the big stick in his right hand and Osif had the little stick, the baton in his left. The Mexican runner didn't know that he wasn't in a race. He thought he was in a race. So even after running 50 miles, he sped up to try to win. And according to Fog Allen, the crowd went wild.
Wow.
And later on in an interview with Dick Snyder from the Capital Journal, he said, those Mexican runners came in and they thought they were in the race, and he spoke of them in the plural, and really there was only one, but Fog Allen was known to do that. The girl runner set a world record coming in from Topeka in her 30 miles. Her sister had to drop out, blisters, and she couldn't, no wonder they didn't have more, the shoes they wore, which was a little more than tire treads. but it was quite a deal. The very next year, they decided that they would have a marathon where Mexico would choose two people, the United States would choose two people, and Canada would choose two. So the United States drew in Native Americans from all over the country to train at Haskell. The Canadians had two runners, but the Mexicans decided they didn't want to do it because they wouldn't run in anything less than 80 miles. So it ended up that it ended up that Canadians kept their two, the United States entered eight, and the marathon went on without the Mexicans. The Mexican government petitioned the Olympic Committee to put in a 100-mile race, and they wouldn't do it. But Torres, that was his name, Jose Torres, the fellow who finished fourth, did run in the 28 Olympics and got 21st. But that wasn't far enough for him. If it had been 80, he might have won.
I want to paraphrase one of the founders of the Kansas Relays, Fog Allen. He was quoted in a Kansas City Star article as saying, moving the relays out of Memorial Stadium would kill them.
Said that in the 1960s when there were thoughts of moving it there. And there were a lot of people that thought that in 2013.
And in 2013, the Kansas Relays did move out of Memorial Stadium.
Right. That was what prompted me to start to write the book. I didn't want that tradition to be lost, because if the relays indeed would die, I wanted people to know what a spectacular event it had been. As it turned out, the relays at Rock Chalk Park has done just fine and will continue.
Joe Schrag is the author of The Kansas Relays, Track and Field Tradition in the Heartland. It's our first Kansas Notable book for today, books by Kansans or about Kansas, selected by the State Library. Let's travel west for our second Kansas Notable book. The Ogallala Road, A Memoir of Love and Reckoning, is the story of one woman's struggle to keep her family farm and the toll that modern agriculture is taking on our water supply. Julene Bear was the keynote speaker earlier this year at a water symposium in Topeka. I spoke to her at Washburn University.
When I was living out in California, I got very interested in wilderness areas in California. I would go up to the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and then I actually fell in love with the desert so much, the Mojave Desert, that I moved there. And the reason that desert pulled me so much is because it was this wide open, arid, sunny climate like the one I grew up in. So I had a natural affinity for those wide open spaces. So I always loved western Kansas and the buffalo grass prairies and so on. And I had a deep concern over water, simply because I knew how rare and precious it was in western Kansas. And in my travels to wilderness areas, there's nothing I had ever loved more than diving into clean, clear mountain lakes and that sort of thing. So when I discovered that we were using up the water under our land, that was a deep concern to me, and it always troubled me quite a bit.
Tell me about your family's farm.
Okay, when I grew up, we were living in the northwest corner of the northwest corner of Kansas, and we were raising sheep and wheat. My father was a dryland wheat farmer, and he was very expert at nurturing the moisture in his soil, because that's what a dryland farmer has to do. And we were living within our climatic limits. But in the 1960s, in our case, it became possible to irrigate there because irrigation was being developed in our area. And once my father heard what I think of as the call of the Ogallala siren, there was no turning back at that point. And we began, at first we grew sugar beets, and that was quite profitable until the sugar beet plant closed down. And then we began growing corn and soybeans, pinto beans.
You just used the phrase, the call of the Ogallala siren.
I get that Ogallala siren name from a painting by a Lawrence artist named Nancy Marshall. I ran across it on the web, and I was taken by this painting. It depicts this evocative woman, very seductive, image of this woman trailing water out of her fingers, and behind her you can see circles of irrigated cornfields. And she calls the painting the Ogallala Siren. That pretty much captures what did happen in western Kansas. When it became possible to irrigate, the farmers just could not wait to get their hands on that water.
And continues to happen to this day.
Right, and more so than ever, because since the ethanol mandate went into effect in 2007, corn prices went up at one point. They quadrupled at one point. So that meant that more farmers grew more corn. In Kansas, 500,000 more acres of corn have been planted since 2007. And corn is the thirstiest crop we grow in the region, so it takes 14 inches of irrigation water to grow a crop of corn, and that's many times more than the aquifer gets in recharge each year from natural rainfall and snowmelt.
Some of the efforts to try to preserve that water in the Ogallala Aquifer understandably have met with a lot of pushback from people in the area. In your book, The Ogallala Road, you mention an old family friend that you talked to in Goodland, Kansas, and he says, and I'm going to quote you here, "If they put through that zero depletion, you could shoot a bullet down Main Street and not hit anyone."
Right. It was his contention that if we conserved the water in the aquifer by requiring that we take no more out of it than it got from natural recharge each year, which was one proposal at one point that was getting quite a lot of traction, he said that the population would leave western Kansas. It's my contention that irrigation is part of the reason that western Kansas has lost so much population, and that is because in order to have the capital to be competitive, in order to drill irrigation wells and buy all the equipment necessary to irrigate, you have to be a big farmer. So farms have gotten larger and larger, and the number of people who used to live in the counties has naturally diminished as a result of that.
That whole go big or go home.
Get big or get out was the phrase that Earl Butz, the Secretary of Agriculture for Eisenhower, used.
Julene, you wrote this book, The Ogallala Road, as someone who was returning to Kansas from Wyoming, where you were living at the time. Did you find that problematic at all, that you're trying to educate people, western Kansans in particular, who have a stake in this system of agriculture, but you're doing this as an outsider?
Well, my family still owned our farm. At the beginning of this book, I'm writing from the point of view of someone whose father has died and who is now holding the bag, so to speak. I was deeply embroiled in this whole issue on a very personal level, and I was also deeply identified with our land. So deeply identified with it that ever since I decided I was going to become a writer, that's just about all I've ever written about is western Kansas. It was very formative in my own personality and my own sense of who I am and who my family is. So I was feeling this push-pull of these conflicted constructs. On the one hand, wanting to preserve the land and the water for the future, and on the other hand, wanting to make as much money as was possible from it. So I think that's why I had to write the book, is because my conscience was engaged and I couldn't work out that paradox. I couldn't figure out how to work that out. So I tried to write my way to a solution.
Well, you also have the push-pull of the message your father gave to you, which was hang on to that land.
Right. That was his first commandment, hang on to your land. And my brother and I always assumed that we would. We could not even imagine selling the land. But by the time he had died, it was now 2001 when the book opens. That was 4 years later, and we were starting to see a crisis forming on the horizon. We had a farm manager there on the land who was doing a great job farming it, and my brother was doing the financial management from a distance. But the farm manager was ill and old, and it wasn't likely that he was going to be able to keep doing this much longer. So we knew we were going to have to make a critical decision. One of us was going to have to come back there to work directly on the land, or we were going to have to rent it out, or we were going to have to sell it. So all those things were running through my mind when I was out there doing the research as the book opens. And at that point, I met someone out there who was a local rancher who, it turned out, had read my first book. I met him out in the middle of a cow pasture while I was tracing the flow of the Little Beaver toward its outlet in the Republican River. And when he told me he'd read my first book, I was just stunned because I didn't know anybody out there besides my second grade teacher and maybe my freshman English teacher and my mother who had read that book. So a conversation began, and pretty soon a romance ensued. And I think what was going on for me there was I was thinking this was going to be an opportunity for me to maybe live back there again and maybe do some of the things that I wanted to do on that land, which I thought would conserve it better and you know, conserve the water better.
I want to talk about that rancher for a minute,
okay.
Ward. I have to tell you, when I picked up your book, I was expecting one kind of book. And as I started reading, I thought, oh, this is a love story.
I just decided to let her rip and tell the truth. You know, because it was all interrelated and it was all relevant. I would not have been so attracted to that man were it not for this crisis of conscience that was going on. I mean, he was a very smart and wonderful person, but I didn't want to live back in Western Kansas again, and I had a life elsewhere. I didn't think I wanted to live back in Western Kansas again, but subconsciously, I don't think I'd ever longed for anything more than to kind of unite these two divided selves and get back in right relationship with the place that I was from. Hmm.
Julie, do you have an excerpt from your book, The Ogallala Road, that I can get you to read?
Okay. So when we were on the family farm, we were living a very integrated existence. We were enmeshed in that world, and it was a way of life. So when my family moved to town, that began to change, and it changed rather suddenly, obviously. It changed our family's psychology. So the passage I'd like to read is one that illustrates how that happened, what those changes were. On the Carlson farm, we'd all been part of a tapestry, a weave. There were animals and grains, vegetables and prairie, trees and people, play and work, mud and stars, the scents of manure and of flowers. I choose these things at random, and it doesn't matter what order I list them in. A specific list of the 10,000 things, to use a phrase from the Tao Te Ching, would fill many pages. They were all entangled of a piece. But when we traded that farm and moved to town, then when I left Kansas altogether, I became a lone thread. While I was trying to weave myself back into the natural world in the mountains and deserts of California, my family's relationship with our land back home was continuing to unravel. Dad drove to it every day. He didn't live on it. Its meaning had shifted from the seat of our family's life to solely a source of revenue. Dad's success growing crops still affirmed and satisfied him, but his land had become more of a thing to him and to us. It had become a financial asset, not who we were. It is no mistake that we use the same word in English to denote both financial worth and a moral principle we hold dear. In one line of reasoning, I would actually be obeying my father's value system by violating his first precept. Hang on to your land.
That's Julene Bear reading from her book, The Ogallala Road. Thank you so much for visiting with me today.
It was a pleasure.
If you're just joining us, it's our annual Kansas Notable Book Show, the first in a two-part series showcasing some of the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Alex Grecian of Topeka is the best-selling author of the critically acclaimed Scotland Yard Murder Squad thrillers. The first in that series, The Yard, was named a Kansas Notable Book back in 2013. The second, The Black Country, made the list in 2014, and, no surprise, the 2015 Kansas Notable Books list includes his third in the series, The Devil's Workshop. I spoke with Alex Grecian at KPR's Statehouse Bureau about the series. The Scotland Yard Murder Squad books are set in Great Britain, primarily London, around 1890. As a writer, what is it about that setting that speaks to you?
Well, it's a couple of things. It's familiar to us all because we've seen it so many times in movies, on television, and in books. And I grew up reading about Victorian England almost constantly. All of the classics that I read when I was a kid were set in England, and most of them were set in the past. So that felt familiar to me when I was writing. But it's also alien. Their customs and practices are so different from ours, and in some ways, it's difficult to understand why they did some of the things they did and thought the way that they thought. So I can comment on things in our society now obliquely.
One of the things that I found really interesting reading about this time period was the evolution of detective work and some of the practices that we take for granted now in terms of crime scene investigation were just in their very earliest stages.
Yeah, when I started writing this series, I was going to write, in fact, I had written a couple of contemporary mysteries, and there's so much out there. The success of CSI and all the spinoffs, everybody uses CSI now. And so some of the things that I found most fascinating about the technology of catching criminals have kind of been done to death. So I thought it would be interesting to see if you could still apply some of those things when the science was in its infancy, and how many of those things that we take for granted now actually were in use then, and most of them not. but there are enough things that I can play with it a little bit.
Like the collection of fingerprints.
Right. And the fingerprints, what's interesting about that is Scotland Yard didn't adopt fingerprinting until 1906. So I'm fudging the history a little bit, but we didn't know about them back then, in 1890. We just weren't using them. People didn't believe that everybody's fingerprints were different yet. So the fact that the technology or the science of it did exist meant that I could have sort of a rogue forensic investigator go ahead and adopt that practice, even though it's not official.
The two main characters in the Murder Squad mysteries are Inspector Walter Day and Sergeant Neville Hammersmith. Talk to me about their relationship.
Well, when I started the series, I wanted to be able to bounce the characters off of each other, and I wanted each character to represent sort of a different sector of who we are as people. So Day is very much the middle character. He's the strength, the physical aspect of who we are. Hammersmith is the emotion. He's all about the action. He's Bruce Willis in Victorian England. So he's just going to dive in and take care of things, and he has no patience for Victorian customs and mores. And then Dr. Kingsley is the intellectual aspect. So I can play them all off of each other, and depending on what kind of scene I want to write, I can pick and choose and jump back and forth.
And then, of course, a recurring character in these books is Jack the Ripper.
Yes.
How do you bring a fresh approach to someone who's been written about so many times?
Right, and I wasn't originally going to include him in the series. It was just going to be about the aftermath of what he did. And it made it very hard when I decided I needed to actually show him, to figure out how I could change him enough to use him and make him my own. And so really, his name is Jack the Ripper in the series, but he's my own character. Because my serial killers in my books don't victimize women. And I try to steer away from that because I think it's A, ugly and gross, and it's been done to death, and I'm tired of it. So if I'm going to use a serial killer, I want him to have something different going on, and I want to explore his psyche. So I needed something to happen to Jack the Ripper to give him a different agenda and a different motivation. And so that's basically what the Devil's Workshop is about particularly, but everything that goes on from the yard forward, he's in the background somewhere, just waiting to spring out at us.
Each of these Murder Squad books opens with a nursery rhyme, which in the context of these books, they're really sinister.
Right, and I chose them for that. And in The Black Country, I wrote the nursery rhyme myself. Actually, I'm getting my books confused. It might have been The Devil's Workshop, but...
No, I think it was The Black Country.
Was it? Okay. And then in The Harvest Man, my new one, I used Robert Louis Stevenson a lot because I thought A Child's Garden of Verses I always thought was creepy, even when I was a little kid. But so many people love those poems and don't see the creepy aspect to them, so I thought it'd be fun to stir them into the mix and give them a different resonance.
Can I get you to read an excerpt?
Okay, in The Devil's Workshop, in the beginning, it concerns a train being used to plow through a prison wall and free some prisoners. So the rest of the book is about tracking down and trying to catch the prisoners. So it starts this way. The locomotive rocked and bounced along the tracks, swaying from side to side and picking up speed as the last load of coal in its firebox burned away. The track approached the southwest corner of HM Prison Bridewell's outer wall, then curved sharply to the east, but there was no driver to slow the engine and ease it around the bend. The train had accelerated to 40 miles an hour by the time the prison hove into view, and the engine slammed through the curve, dragging 10 carriages behind it. The loose couplings between them contracted and then quickly stretched taut as the carriages moved forward and back to accommodate the sudden turn. 7 carriages from the front, the middle link in the chain snapped where it had been weakened. The back of the train tilted, then slammed down onto the rails. A forward wheel jumped the track and unmoored and emptied the final 3 carriages, left the rails, and powered down the embankment toward the prison walls as the front half of the train continued through the curve and away.
That's Alex Grecian of Topeka reading from The Devil's Workshop. It's the third in his Scotland Yard Murder Squad series. A fourth, The Harvest Man, was released in May 2015. This year's Kansas Notable Books list includes fiction, nonfiction, and, as always, a bit of poetry. Our next book is a collaboration between former Kansas Poet Laureate Karen Miriam Goldberg and photographer Stephen Locke. It's called Chasing Weather, Tornadoes, Tempests, and Thunderous Skies in Word and Image.
I think I've been talking to the weather all my life. I mean, weather's fascinating, and I grew up in New Jersey and Brooklyn. Occasionally we'd get a hurricane, but nothing like this, and I didn't have such a good view of the skies out back there. But when I first moved to the Midwest, I was just blown away by the skies, by the weather. How things changed and spoke to me through the weather. And I realized that I'd been writing about weather most of my life in my poetry. It has been a guiding force, especially wind, which makes it very wise to live in Kansas if you like to write about wind.
This book is rather unusual, or it's a bit of a departure in that it's not just poetry. It is beautiful photographs that illustrate these incredible images about the weather and its presence in Kansas. What was it like working with Stephen Locke, and how did you bring those pictures and words together?
Stephen is somebody I met before I met in person on Facebook, and I was looking at his photographs. He friended me. And, you know, I friended him, and he would look at my poems, and I was poet laureate at the time, and I didn't realize that he had been thinking about doing a collaborative with a writer, and then he thought, well, why not try the Kansas Poet Laureate?
Let's start at the top.
Yeah, why not? Well, I don't know if it's the top, but it's somewhere in the field, and I had been thinking about collaborating with a photographer. I had actually asked one who turned me down. And one day Stephen posted an image and I just wrote, this is so poetic. And he wrote me right then and said, would you like to do a book together? And I wrote back and said yes. And a few months later, we met in person. I believe we first met at Prima Tassa. And we just started working on this, and it took about 4 years. And he let me have access to his photo collection. And Stephen is probably out right now shooting storms. He travels throughout our big tornadic storm season in March, April, May, June, July, and just devotes himself to making these photographs that are unlike photographs of weather I've hardly ever seen before. He's not a close-up storm chaser. He shoots from enough of a distance to get a vista, and he really looks at he's really able with his camera to capture many new ways for us to see the sky. The more you look at his photographs, the more you start to see the sky new ways. And I know it's a little abstract to describe incredible photographs on the radio, but people, if you're listening and you got a device near you, it's tempestgallery.com, T-E-M-P-E-S-T, gallery.com, and you can see what I mean by how he shoots supercells and tornadoes and sunsets and fog and all kinds of other things.
Something you just said really resonated with me, which was that he takes pictures of these storms from a distance and that you get a kind of a larger perspective. And maybe that's what you're doing with your poetry when you write about the weather as well.
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful compliment. I think William Blake said something about how the way to the universal is through the specific, but you need to have the right perspective at the same time. So the more, as a poet, I can kind of zero in on what specifically needs to be said here, trying to clear my mind and my ideas out of the way and bring to the surface the poem, that whole process is about gaining that perspective. And then trying to go through the specific to the universal.
What is it that you think the images of Stephen Locke bring to your poetry? Or conversely, what is it that your poetry or that you hope that your poetry brings to his pictures?
Well, there's nothing like a good collaboration. And I'm just so lucky in this life that one of my main collaborators is Kelly Hunt, and we write songs together. And now I work with Stephen Locke, and we do photographs and poetry together. When you're working with another artist who's willing to hold your hand and jump off the cliff with you, you know, sometimes you can land in very new places. Occasionally you crash. As the old saying goes, sometimes you fly. But with visual art, I find that when I'm really engaged with a certain image, it starts to change the way I see. I mean, it does really expand your peripheral vision. An example is the paintings of the late Joan Foth, one of my favorite painters. She did the cover of Prairie Earth. One of her paintings is on my book, The Sky Begins at Your Feet. And she does these kind of layers of color to show skyscapes that has helped me to understand the layers in the sky. With Stephen's photographs, when I look at the cover photo, which I'm holding up for you out there in Radio Land, you can see it now, it's a giant supercell. It's like just a huge round column of a thing turning, and you can see lightning coming out the side. When I look at these photos, they not only help me to understand weather patterns more, but how weather occupies the sky and the land and how it kind of sweeps through our lives.
Karen, can I get you to read us one of the poems from Chasing Weather and perhaps describe the photograph that accompanies it?
Okay, I would love to. This is a photograph that incidentally was on the cover of my novel, The Divorce Girl. If you're a writer, it's really good to be friends with a photographer for great cover images. And it's simply an Osage orange tree. And behind it, the tree takes up maybe half the photo, just the top of the tree. And you can see the stars burning through these wispy clouds, the remnant clouds of a huge storm. And this actually was taken in 2011 in Perry, Oklahoma. The Night Sky Following a Tornado Outbreak. And it was a tornado that did a great deal of damage and tragically killed 8 people. And Stephen was in a campsite nearby, just shooting the sky. So this is called After the Storm, the Stars. Rise from the Osage orange, wheeling overhead as if nothing has changed in the fresh heart of the air, cleansed free of all but wind without end, lashing leaf against leaf. The rays of remnant clouds burn translucent, exposed dirt ages in the wind. The grass tangles a slat from a child's doll cradle. Paper from 2 towns away lifts to ferry important words nowhere. The sky exhales, waits, drops to the disturbed ridge where flowers rock upside down. The pebbles from elsewhere dream of the old days, and in the off and on cadence of the train's whistle, someone cries. Tomorrow, not so far from here, search dogs and careful lifting of sheetrock and broken furniture, bulldozers, power saws, rented U-Hauls to unearth, sort, dry out and save, then clear whatever's left. Months ahead to measure what was lost, calculate this day's weather and read the braille of the stories left behind. The new world not conjured arrives here anyway, and over the sprawling tree of life, the stars.
Karen, that is a poem about a very real weather event, as are a number of the poems in Chasing Weather. But I'm wondering to what extent, when you write about weather, you're using it as a metaphor for what is greater than all of us.
I often am in the poems, and I could actually read another example
sure.
that's much more metaphoric. You know, on one hand, you don't want to be cheesy about it, you know, like this means this, this means that, because we don't really know what anything means. You know, we all have our own ways of naming it, and I think we're on this earth to name and claim it and experience it as our own. But weather is kind of like our emotions. You know, whatever you feel is like this big prima donna. You feel depressed, and that depression acts like you will never feel anything again. It's raining cats and dogs, and it seems like it will never stop. And then, of course, something else sweeps in. So this is a poem that goes with an image from Victoria, Kansas, way out west where there's that beautiful church. And it's basically this... It's a rear flank downdraft with inflow jet, for those of you weather enthusiasts. And what it looks like is this dark cloud over the land. You can see a little light. And part of it is coming down, and part of the leftover clouds on the ground are rising up. So there's clouds meeting in the middle. And it's probably close to sunset. You rise up to meet the falling world. Whatever you lift to the sky covers. Middle of the night, exaggerations dissolve to slivers of sadness on your pillow. Middle of life jolts compress the heavens into one streak of sleet, thawing into softer ground. Like the rain cycle that obscures the view, you can lose your way on old ground or forget the innate blue light in everything, ready again. The surface of the tall grass spins in the breeze. It twirls into existence. The present twists down to meet you each time you catch your foot. Stars inform daylight or its absence. We are made to catch the falling world, just as the earth is shaped perfectly to catch us.
That's Karen Miriam Goldberg reading from Chasing Weather, Tornadoes, Tempests and Thunderous Skies in Word and Image. It's a collaboration between the former Kansas Poet Laureate and photographer Stephen Locke. Kansas Public Radio has a copy of Chasing Weather to give away, along with several other Kansas Notable books. If you'd like a chance to win a Kansas Notable book, go to our website, kpr.ku.edu. Click on Extras and then Available Giveaways. Again, that's kpr.ku.edu. Our next Kansas Notable author is another familiar voice to KPR listeners. Tom Averill is writer-in-residence at Washburn University and is a regular contributor to Kansas Public Radio. His holiday-themed book is A Carol Dickens Christmas.
This book, in many ways, is a homage or tribute to Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Even the title, of course, is sort of a mixed-up version of that, which I thought was clever, but which, if you Google A Carol Dickens Christmas by Thomas Fox Averill, you get 3 pages of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol before you ever get to my humble book. But the whole idea for the book really started because my family would make Christmas trips to Dallas, Texas to visit grandparents. And when our daughter was young, we wanted to entertain ourselves. And we started reading Christmas Carol aloud. And it takes about 8 hours to read Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol and get us in the Christmas spirit. And we started doing some meals from the novel, imaginary meals, and we still read segments of A Christmas Carol on Christmas Eve every year. So we all take turns reading it to each other. It takes us about an hour to read what we've got it down to. So I know the book quite well, and a lot of those phrases and a lot of the structure of the book just sort of came naturally out of that.
So where did you get the idea to riff on A Christmas Carol? What made you think, you know what, I think I could have some fun with Charles Dickens?
Well, Christmas is a wonderful structure, if you think about it. As a writer, we all have our rituals and our traditions, and we all start getting intense about them sometime after Thanksgiving, and then we put them all away. Some of us the day after Christmas, some of us after the New Year, some of us after the 12th day of Christmas, and so on. So I was attracted to it as a structure. We all know what it's like to have to think about other people in that way, who's coming to dinner, who are we giving gifts to, who are we sending cards to this year, are we traveling, are we staying home, are we buying a tree, are we putting up decorations, and every year you get out the same decorations, and oh, look, remember, you know, there's all this, the sense of the past that comes into there, and so then I thought, well, if I did a Christmas novel in which someone was sort of giving her son, Carol Dickens is giving her son Finn, his sort of last traditional all the way through Christmas at home before he goes to college, that this would be an interesting sort of look at traditions versus transitions and this moment in someone's life where things are changing.
That's Topeka author Tom Averill talking about A Carol Dickens Christmas. It's just one of this year's Kansas Notable books, perfect for the book lover on your Christmas list. Be sure to tune in next week when we'll hear an excerpt from A Carol Dickens Christmas on our KPR Presents Holiday Show. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.